Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the psychology of political life. It is often thought that budgets start to unravel almost as soon as the Chancellor sits down after giving his speech, as people pick apart the fine details. A budget might showcase tax tweaks and policy aspirations, but there is also usually a framing device to provide a narrative or a story which the voter will become attached to psychologically. And this was no exception, with Jeremy Hunt describing it as a back-to-work budget. So what does that tell us about the overall narrative of the Conservative Party? What is the party's psychology of money as presented in this particular budget? Are they in danger of alienating voters who have a different money mindset? And actually, were people really paying attention to the budget at all? To help me analyse this, I'm delighted to welcome back to On the Couch the editor of Reaction, Maggie Pagano. Hello, Maggie.
Hello, Lucy.
Now, you had a particularly busy 24 hours, and it wasn't just about the budget.
No, it wasn't. And, you know, it was very odd because as we were all trying to follow the budget, listen to Hunt, work out, as exactly as you said, you know, the sleights of hand, because there's a lot of sort of magic work that goes on. And as we write these budgets, we sort of know that within a day or so, we've missed the story. There's something there tucked away, you know, in clause, whatever, that actually brings it all out. But back to what I was saying, the real story, of course, was the sort of, well, pseudo collapse of European banking shares following the collapse of SVB last week in America, with Credit Suisse, you know, it's been through problems, one of the most, you know, solid at core banks in Switzerland. And there its shares were collapsing to new lows, and the Swiss National Bank has had to step in and provide it with liquidity. And of course, once you have this, it is the domino effect, and everybody then looks at everybody else's, all the other banks, and there is a ripple effect, and markets worldwide were collapsing around us. So it was a tricky thing to follow.
And on that note, not least because it's a very fine balance, isn't it, between actually giving support, which, as you say, the Swiss bank did, but actually also giving the psychology of that, of making people realise that there was a problem whereby they needed to step in the first place. Is there a real risk of contagion, or has that fear gone away?
I don't think that fear will ever go away. And I don't think we know the answer to that, because if you remember at the weekend, everybody said, well, Silicon Valley Bank is a very different cup of tea. It's led mainly to the tech center, and there'll be no contagion. And then within 24 hours, you had another bank, Signature Bank, going bust. So there's always fear. And of course, what we've seen over the last year with the US and other central banks raising interest rates, there are a lot of people who have been caught with very big bond portfolios that now are showing losses. And we just don't know the extent to that. And the big question today, as we're speaking, is whether the European Central Bank will go ahead with its half point interest rate rise. I suspect it won't, or it might just go with 0.25%.
So we will be watching.
I think that will change the psychology of the market. You know, already in 3 days, last week, Jerome Powell, head of the US Federal Reserve, was saying, we're not stopping, we're not letting up, we're going to be really aggressive, we want to stamp out inflation. Everybody's looking for another hike next week from the Federal Reserve. Christine Lagarde a few weeks ago, no, we're going to stamp it out 0.5%, you know, all big, jolly, despite lots of warnings, actually. And I have been on, I have to not saying I was right, but you could see the dangers of what they were doing. And we'll just see today. So the psychology, the pressure now has switched fundamentally, yes.
Mm. And therefore, it's going to be quite hard for Jeremy Hunt, I guess, to keep talking about the budget when, in fact, his eyes are going to be elsewhere. But he is going to need to talk about it because, as I said in my introduction, there is always that unpicking that takes place as the commentators have their immediate input. And then there's usually some snap polling, although it was quite interesting that the polling last night, I think it was from YouGov, the majority of people didn't know the answer to the question. So in fact, maybe snap coding after a budget.
What was just the question?
I think it was fundamentally, do you think this budget was a good thing? Is it going to make you better off? And 54% said, we don't know that yet. Yeah. But it was very...
it was one of those budgets, actually. That's true. It's a good. It was the right answer.
In the sense, why do you say that?
Because it was very, I mean, usually we get an income tax, going up a bit, rates changing. You could sort of do a picture of your family finances. From this one, it was, as you said at the beginning, Lucy, back to work, very specific policies. They were, I think the ambition is a good one, to want to ease up, make this 7 million economically inactive, such a horrible expression. And it needs to be reframed, come back to work, particularly the 500,000 people who'd have decided post-COVID that they don't want to come back to work, that they don't need to, that they want other things. And I think, and then you had the childcare package, which already, it's going to be another 2 years. And actually these are, but the disability changes also were very good. I thought it sort of showed there was sort of quite a compassionate side, the Ian Duncan Smith social justice. I think that's been missed a bit. There was some, and fostering, there was some quite nice in the background little changes. But let's go back to the scrapping of the lifetime allowance, which not a single newspaper had, actually. It was quite rare, usually they try and leak these things.
Yes, there was definitely a sense that something might happen to it, but people assumed that it would just be a raising of the threshold. And as a result, as you say, most of that post-budget oxygen was taken up with the abolition of it. But it was framed very much around getting doctors back off the golf course and less around aspiration for anybody who might want to have a pension pot of that size.
Lucy, I so agree with that. And I was thinking about it afterwards that there is a specific problem within the NHS. And I actually know quite a few of my consultants myself who have retired and been moaning about this for years and who've moved over into private practice and, doing more time hiking and, as you say, golf course. So there was a specific problem. And actually, politically, it's quite clever of them to have specified those.
Not least because Wes Streeting actually suggested doing that about three or four months ago.
But I think I wrote it in my piece last night. Very difficult, although Rachel Reeves this morning is slightly backtracking on it. Very difficult for Labour now to say, well, you can't do that. We don't want doctors going back into the workplace. How can they possibly? So it was quite clever for them. But they did miss the point. And this is where the narrative of tax cutting didn't come in. What a liberal, classical liberal Conservative Party would want to do is simplify taxes, take away all the loopholes. And as we know, the very rich can always afford to avoid inheritance tax and they could set up trusts. The ordinary man in the street can't. But he does now know that his pension fund will be allowed to grow. And there's been a lot of criticism saying, oh, it's going to cost the general taxpayer 66,000 or something, over a lifetime. It won't hit most people. But the point is, if you're a builder or electrician or run a sweet shop, whatever it is, you have aspiration. You would hope that you can grow those businesses. And something we keep coming back to, small businesses in Britain are still the lifeblood of the economy. They create most jobs, they provide most jobs, over 60%, and wealth. So I think it was a clever move. I can see why he honed in on the NHS, but he should spell it out that this is obviously for everybody.
That it would help actually more people. But since you have raised the topic of smaller businesses, I was quite surprised that he didn't seem to do as much for smaller businesses. So we could talk about the corporation tax. He was obviously determined not to give in to any of those commentators who had argued for it remaining where it was, or certainly not being raised as much as it has been. Where do you stand on the matter of corporation tax? And why do you think he didn't really support, as you call them, the lifeblood of the British economy, the smaller businesses?
I absolutely have been one of those people who've been haranguing for weeks, months, that it was a retrograde move. I guess it was something introduced by the Prime Minister when he was Chancellor, and I guess they felt they just needed to have something there as a backstop. Now, the interest is still, we are still relatively low tax economy compared to other OECD countries. It's not a great move, mainly because of the uncertainty it creates. I think that's what, again, businesses want to plan. So if you're an overseas business, or like AstraZeneca, it was going to build a new manufacturing plant up in Macclesfield, and then that came along. It wasn't the only decision, actually, that changed, switched its mind. Went to Ireland, where it's 12.5%, and it will stay 12.5%. So it is it's a bad move, but it only affects, not only, it affects 10% of all businesses. Having said that, 500,000, I was talking to the Federation of Small Businesses yesterday, they reckon about 500,000 of their small businesses will be hit by that 25%. Mm-hmm. And they are quite small ones who you could say, so if you're paying that, if you're paying that extra wage in tax, it means that you probably won't employ one more person, or you might not invest in. And these are very finely balanced, and they're more finely balanced for small businesses. They did get some R&D tax credit relief, which was a good thing. But actually, it was big business, once again, that got the full expensing. So I don't know, actually, Lucy. And I find it very curious, because you would have thought that the 5.5 million small companies employing 16 million people would be natural conservatives, mm-hmm. aspirational, hardworking, so, and swing voters. So,
and also, as you say, also hitting that sweet spot of back to work, because if small businesses can grow, then they can, as you have said in your previous answer, that they can hire more people, and actually you're opening up that opportunity for people to work, and therefore, as a narrative device, as a way to sort of create your story about what you're trying to do in your own particular budget, he said it was a back to work budget, but then in the end it wasn't totally. So why do you think he did that, when in fact that wasn't the title, like the headline of an article not really tallying with the rest of the article? To me, it was about trying to make it sound very everyday, so that you're really relating to every woman or man in the street who just wants to talk about work as a source of income, as a way of tackling the cost of living crisis, having more money in your pocket. But actually, the narrative didn't hold up.
No, it didn't. And as I say, it's curious. I don't understand why, unless it is, I hate to sort of always fall back on what's quite a simple excuse, which is that Jeremy Hunt, even though he was a small businessman, set up Language, something or other, wasn't it? Publishing, is that the Treasury, most of the people who work in the Treasury have not worked in business, and they don't know enough small businesses. So all the lobbying, most of the lobbying they get is from other big businesses. Our Prime Minister worked for Goldman Sachs and big hedge funds. You know, they don't know what it's like to employ three people on payroll, and do you have enough money to pay them next week? Or the Norfolk brewer that I spoke to, not last summer, the summer before, no, last summer, his energy bill had gone from 11,000 a year to 42,000. You know, when you're doing big, the machines required for the brewing require huge temperatures, so huge amount of energy, you know, cooling and heating and so forth. And he said quite, you know, openly, I'm going to pay this. I'm not going to ask for any support, but it just means I'm not going to employ another person, you know. And you see this black and white. And I wonder if people in the Treasury just don't get it. And that's something he announced, the continuation of the energy package for householders. But once again, he hasn't mentioned what would be done for small business. That would have been such an easy thing to do.
Such an easy win.
easy one.
Can I take you back to something you raised earlier, which was the childcare policy, but again, the fact that it doesn't kick in for another couple of years. So it's really targeting babies that haven't been born yet. I mean, babies that haven't even been conceived yet, actually, one might argue. But the other thing that was commented on at the time overnight was that, in effect, it was a pinching of a Labour policy. Do you think voters worry about that? Do voters think, I'm not going to vote for you because you stole that policy from another
Absolutely
party?
Absolutely not. Probably most people wouldn't have a clue that that was a Labour policy. I have a very radical thoughts on childcare, and my worry always with these budgets is that they fiddle around the edges whilst, if you like, Rome burns. And sorry to mix my metaphors. And that is, I would quite simply make all childcare tax deductible. If you talk to any, particularly if we're talking about senior, and I think that they're different things, different groups that you have to perhaps appeal to. You know, why aren't there enough senior executives on the boards? All this sort of quite a lot of nonsense spoken, actually. And childcare is always
female senior executives, you mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think fathers care about childcare too. I mean, this is the other thing. It's not just a female woman problem, is it? It's particularly now.
But there is a problem with women on boards. That really is a problem.
Well, I don't know that it's a problem, actually, but that's another debate, Lucy. We'll have one. I think, you know, it's about access. Do they have access? And actually, women on boards in the FTSE 250 and 350 have been phenomenal. It's now over 40%, you know, with just by carrots. No, it's childcare. Just in the same way that business has been able to expense plant and machinery, okay, get full expensing. I don't see, if you're going out to work, you're investing in yourself and in your family unit. Why shouldn't that be expensed?
And have you ever floated that with anyone at the Treasury?
Not directly. I have written it ad nauseum, Lucy, for 20 years.
I've read it, but I just want to know whether they're reading it.
Probably they do, and they go, oh, it's far too expensive. But actually, it's something you've reminded me. I'll ask some think tank if they've done the numbers and what it would cost to make it tax deductible compared to what they're spending. Is it 5 billion a year on this? Now, the other point is, you can see why they can't do it for 2 years. Number one, nurseries will need, they'll need more staff, because the ratio, especially if you've got more babies going into nurseries, you need, I think a normal nursery is about 1 in 5 or certain age groups, and I'm not sure of the specifics. And if you've got more babies, now whether they should be in childcare, that's another debate as well. You need 1 in 9, because obviously changing a nappy takes longer. So the nursery providers will need more staff. You can't just, we haven't got the Norland nanny school, you know, can't suddenly provide.
Yes, and you can't have the luxury of a one-to-one ratio. And as you say, there's always going to be that conflict between whether children are better off with their parents around them for the whole time, for the whole of that first year, or whether it's better that they actually get to learn about being socialized and learning to share and have other benefits of going into the nursery.
Like most things, Lucy, it's a happy balance, isn't it? And it's really the balance that you as a family want. You shouldn't be, you know, your finances shouldn't be such that you're forced out to work, but also with the way that we can all work from home now, part-time, you know, most families seem to be able to. But for that policy to work, we need higher quality nurses. We need more staff, more training. But what I do not understand, the Treasury haven't done, why have they not given some sort of financial incentive for grandparents? We have an aging population who are much fitter than they have been for years. A lot of them now don't want to work. Why can't they be paid, as they do in Holland and a few other European countries? Why aren't they why can't they be paid instead of going to a nursery? I think most of us would agree that being with your grandparents, I mean, I think a lot of grandparents might not want to take on this burden, but again, because they're off on the golf course. You know, that seems to be an easy win. I don't understand.
So finally, if you had been giving this budget, you've already given me actually a couple of real zinger policies that you would probably have tried to formulate. But yeah, if it had been your budget yesterday and you'd been standing up, what would have been the main thrusts for you? Would you have had a narrative? Would you have had an overarching vision to convey?
I wouldn't have this back to work. I'd say let's make it easier to come back to work if you wish. And have you seen the name he's given, the returnerships?
Yes. Oh. I hope that doesn't catch on.
No, we need to change that. And no, it is. Okay, let's be very, very serious here. There are 7 million people economically inactive. The question is, and that breaks down, there's sort of hardcore. Students are now excluded from that number because otherwise it was 9. I think that's correct. Pensioners, I think, about 1.5 to 2. So there are about 5 million people. The question is to ask is how many of these people want to work? And then if they want to work, what we know is a lot of people, if they've lost their jobs, lose confidence, perhaps they've been unwell. And to be fair to the government, they have, from what I hear, within the Department of Work and Pensions, they are doing a lot of coaching. But I think that that is something you want to encourage. So you want to maybe the job centres. I mean, why are job centres the most depressing places on earth? Same with doctor's surgeries. All these places have sort of could replace community centres. I think there's far more that we can do to bring people together, give them confidence, give them coaching, and help them back to work rather than this sort of almost totalitarian back to work, please.
The problem we've got is that a lot of people have now made a very different quality of life decision about what they want, how they want to live their life post-pandemic. The pandemic and lockdowns in particular, and the opportunity and maybe headspace that it gave people to think about what they want to do with their life, as opposed to the rat race that they might have been on, or that treadmill of commuting and being taxed to the hilt. There were choices that people started to make that haven't really got anything to do with it, whether you can incentivize someone through tweaks to the pension planning, that actually there might need to be a wider conversation in society about the psychology of work and what it means to people. As you say, it can boost people's confidence as well as the money in their pocket. It can give them a sense of status. But that does then go back to the psychology of money mindset, because some people are very driven by status, and some people are driven by saving money. Some people are driven by crunching the numbers. Some people are just driven by different things. And society and maybe governments in general are just not having conversations around what to do now that the world of work has fundamentally changed.
You pose many interesting points, Lucy. And I think that perhaps another one to add to that is that the 500,000 who clearly have the financial support backing to now retire post-COVID, probably that most of them have been very successful people in their careers and business, and we're losing that experience, which goes back to the one of the disadvantages of working from home, particularly from the youngsters, is that they don't learn from their elders. They don't have the water cooler moment. They don't have the encouragement, the wisdom. Certainly all the youngsters, particularly sort of 25 to early 30s, early, you know, start of their careers, they were the ones who really didn't like working from home, young lawyers and accountants and so forth. We are social creatures. I mean, it might well be, mightn't it, that those 500,000 will get a little bit bored post-pandemic.
As the cost of living crisis continues, they may just literally look at and think, I can't afford to not work.
Professor at London Business School, I forget, Professor Andrew, I've forgotten his surname. Sorry, Andrew. He's written the 100-year career. I mean, what he says, we will all have multiple careers, as we're seeing, and we've got to be much more resilient about dipping in and out. And these are big cultural changes we're talking about, aren't they? And so we're sort of treading through them rather muddied. But more interesting than the 500,000, to my mind, Lucy, more interesting than those 500,000 who've made it out of a choice are some of the 5 million who perhaps have never had jobs, don't want to work, can't work, are frightened to work. They're the people surely we should be helping, because they're the ones who will maybe go on to have more mental and physical illnesses, problems, because whether we like it or not, work does give us structure, whether it's status.
Structure and self-worth.
And self-worth, self-esteem, meaning, purpose.
And most people, I would have loved some of that phraseology to have crept into the budget speech yesterday. Yeah. Maggie Pagano, editor of Reaction, thank you so much indeed for being my guest on the
couch. That's a pleasure, Lucy. You made me think.